Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling something really critical. How massive amounts of data, right? How that's being used to understand and prepare for climate change and disasters.
Yeah, and specifically looking at what this means for developing countries.
Exactly, because they're often, well, right on the front lines of these challenges.
We've got some really interesting stuff to dig into here. Our base is a pretty thorough report from the Data Pop Alliance that was back in 2015. It had support from the UK's DFID, NERC, ESRC, a big collaboration.
Okay, so a solid foundation.
Definitely. And we're layering on top of that more recent work on things like cloud computing, machine learning, and climate models, which is huge now, and all the amazing detail from satellite data.
Right. So for you tuning in, maybe you want to get a handle on this quickly, get the big picture without getting totally lost in the technical stuff. Our goal here is to pull out the really key insights, the sort of game-changing bits. Think of it as your shortcut to understanding how data is becoming this powerful tool for resilience, hopefully with a few aha moments along the way.
Sounds good. So where should we start? To really get the impact of big data, maybe we first need to talk about why disasters, well, become disaster.
Okay.
It's not just the hazard itself, the earthquake or the storm. It's how that hazard interacts with communities that are vulnerable.
Vulnerability.
And resilience is the key to reducing that vulnerability. It's basically how susceptible a place or a community is to harm, or how likely they are to suffer loss.
And resilience isn't just about like bouncing back super fast, is it? I feel like there's more to it.
That's a really important distinction, actually. Yeah. Bouncing back quickly, that's more like robustness. Resilience goes a bit deeper. It's about a system keeping its main structure and functions going, even when it's under stress.
Okay, maintaining function.
And a really fundamental part of that is adaptability, the ability to adjust, to change, to evolve when faced with new pressures.
Got it. Adaptability.
Yeah, think of like a system that can learn and change versus one that just breaks.
So what kind of things actually build that resilience in a community, say?
Well, some are pretty straightforward. Better early warning systems, for instance, gives people time
Sure.
or infrastructure, like buildings designed to withstand earthquakes.
Makes sense.
Disaster drills help prepare people. But then there are other things, maybe less obvious, like having really effective public health systems in place before something happens. They're crucial afterward.
Ah, right. And social connections.
Exactly. Well-functioning social networks, community groups, they provide vital support during recovery. It's not just about physical stuff.
Now, the sources we looked at really emphasize that developing countries often face, well, a tougher situation with disasters. Why is that the case?
Yeah, it's unfortunately a convergence of several factors. You often have higher population densities in cities.
More people exposed.
Right. And more settlements built up along coastlines, making them more vulnerable to, say, storm surges or sea level rise.
Okay.
And then the big one, the projected increase in hydrometeorological hazards, floods, droughts, storms driven by climate change, is expected to hit these regions particularly hard.
So it feels like the thinking is shifting. It's not just about cleaning up afterwards anymore.
Precisely. There's a much stronger recognition now that investing in disaster risk reduction isn't just a humanitarian issue. It's actually crucial for development, for sustainable development.
Building resilience saves money and lives down the road.
Exactly. And that's really where the potential of big data starts to come into sharp focus.
Okay, perfect transition. So we see why resilience is vital. How does this world of big data actually help build it? What are we even talking about when we say big data here?
Good question. In this context, big data means these just incredibly vast and complex data sets. They come from all sorts of places. Think satellite images constantly beaming down, outputs from complex climate models trying to predict the future, huge historical climate archives, even sometimes things like social media chatter can provide useful signals.
Wow, okay. That sounds like a lot of data. How do you possibly make sense of it all, especially when you're trying to prepare for something or react to a crisis?
That's the challenge and where the analysis tools come in. But just having the data opens up possibilities across the whole disaster management cycle. Maybe we can break that cycle down. The first stage is really monitoring hazards.
Monitoring. So, like keeping an eye on potential threats before they happen.
Exactly that. And we're seeing huge improvements here, particularly with satellite sensors getting much higher resolution. NASA has missions like GRACE, that's Gravity Recovery and Climate Experiment. It helps track groundwater depletion, which is a massive indicator for drought risk.
Okay, tracking water from space.
Yeah. And another one, SME, Soil Moisture Active Passive, gives us incredibly detailed soil moisture data. That's vital for monitoring drought, obviously, but also for things like estimating crop yields, especially in places where we don't have much on the ground data.
It's like giving the planet a constant checkup.
Kind of, yeah, checking its vital signs. These sensors can even help detect when dryland ecosystems are losing resilience, getting close to a tipping point.
So satellites give us the view from above. What about information from people on the ground?
That's where crowdsourcing gets really interesting. Ordinary people acting like a distributed sensor network. The sources mention examples like monitoring volcanoes. Sometimes even a small number of informed local observers can provide critical real-time updates where official monitoring is thin.
Wow.
And there's Uganda's UReport system. It uses simple SMS messages for government communication, but also lets citizens report hazards or issues they see directly.
That's amazing. So citizens contributing directly to the data pool.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're monitoring hazards. What's next in the cycle?
Next, you need to figure out what or who is actually at risk if that hazard occurs. That's assessing exposure and vulnerability.
Right. Where are the danger zones? What infrastructure is there?
Exactly. Satellite images are huge here, too, for identifying geographic risks like slopes prone to landslides or spotting buildings and roads in floodplains.
And I guess you need that ground level detail again to really make sense of the satellite view.
Absolutely. And this is where projects like OpenStreetMap have been revolutionary. It's basically volunteers mapping the world, often using local knowledge, sometimes combined with freely available aerial
I've
photos.
heard of OpenStreetMap.
It's huge now, something like 1.5 million registered users globally. And the local detail, they add individual buildings, road types, local landmarks. It's incredibly valuable for validating satellite data and for planning like evacuation
Like
routes.
a collective effort to build this super detailed living map.
Pretty much. And beyond mapping physical features, we can use other types of big data too, like anonymized call detail records, CDRs from mobile phones.
Phone records. How does that help?
Well, analyzing calling patterns and movement between cell towers can give surprisingly good estimates of population density and distribution, even how it changes during the day.
Wow, okay.
It can also sometimes provide rough indicators of socioeconomic status. This has been used in the UK and Rwanda. Lots of places to understand population dynamics better.
Okay, so we've monitored the hazard, we've assessed who and what is vulnerable, but sometimes disasters still strike. How does big data help in the immediate response phase?
That's about guiding disaster response. And speed is critical here. Social media analysis, for instance, can sometimes provide very early warnings of secondary impacts, like maybe reports of disease symptoms spreading or people talking about food shortages after a flood.
Using platforms like Twitter or Facebook.
Exactly. And remote sensing satellites again, but also drones are increasingly used, provides rapid damage assessments after something like a hurricane or earthquake hits. That helps target aid much faster.
Get help to the worst hit areas first.
Precisely. And mobile phone data, those CDRs, again, can give insights into how people are actually moving or not moving after an event.
How people react on the ground.
Yeah, there's a fascinating study by Flowminder using Grameen phone data after a big cyclone in Bangladesh. They saw communication spikes before the storm hit, suggesting people were getting warnings and maybe preparing.
Okay, that makes sense.
But interestingly, despite the warnings, they didn't see evidence of mass displacement. People mostly stayed put.
Really? Huh.
Yeah, which kind of raises questions about how effective the warnings were, or maybe how people perceived the risk, or perhaps they just couldn't leave. It shows this data can be used to almost audit how well early warning programs are working in reality.
That's a powerful feedback loop. So it's not just about immediate reaction. Can big data help us be more, I guess, strategic about building resilience long term?
Definitely. The report talks about prescriptive or diagnostic applications. This is where you use data analysis to try and figure out causal links. For example, analyzing historical data to see if diversifying the types of crops farmers grow in a region actually made them more resilient to subsequent droughts.
Understanding what works.
Exactly. And then there are discursive or engagement applications. This is about using data to spark conversations and collaboration. Things like crowdsourcing specific maps just for disaster relief efforts, getting the community involved in building the tools they need.
And it sounds like this can even help us understand the resilience of ecosystems themselves.
Yes, absolutely. There's mention of things like the Global Intervention Decision Model. It's a tool aimed at improving how we manage agricultural ecosystems, making them more sustainable. And it relies heavily on dynamic, high-res big data.
Like what kind of data?
Satellite data, again, tracking things like soil quality changes, water availability, vegetation health over time. This allows for much more adaptive management strategies.
So tailoring interventions based on real-time conditions.
Exactly. And just the act of making more environmental and social data openly available is powerful. It empowers local communities, planners, everyone to understand the risks better and hopefully take action.
Okay, this is all incredibly promising. But the sheer scale of this data, managing it, processing it, that must be a huge hurdle in itself.
Oh, absolutely huge. And that's where cloud computing is just fundamental. It's the backbone. You need that massive, scalable infrastructure to store, manage, and process these enormous climate and disaster data sets.
Right. You can't do this on a desktop computer.
Not even close. And governments are recognizing this. You see initiatives like the U.S. Federal Data Center Consolidation or India's National Cloud Initiative. They're not just building capacity. They're also trying to make these huge data centers more energy efficient, more sustainable, which is obviously important in the climate context.
Good point. So you have the storage and processing power. Then you need the brains, right? The AI, the machine learning we hear so much about.
Precisely. Artificial intelligence, AI, and machine learning, ML, are really revolutionizing how we do environmental research now. AI can help boost the accuracy of predictions. It can automate incredibly tedious data processing tasks, spot anomalies in climate data that a human might just miss.
Finding patterns in the noise.
Exactly. And ML is fantastic for analyzing these really complex climate patterns, making forecasts, and actually improving the climate models themselves.
How specifically is AI being used in, say, climate modeling? It sounds quite futuristic.
It's happening now. We're seeing AI-powered approaches used to optimize the simulations, make them run faster on supercomputers. ML algorithms are digging through historical data and model outputs to generate more accurate predictions.
Faster and better predictions.
And there's a big shift towards feeding real-time data into these systems, from sensors, satellites, IoT devices, to get much quicker insights as conditions change.
So the models are almost learning on the fly.
In a way, yes. A key area is something called parameterization and emulation in weather and climate models.
Okay, that sounds technical.
It is a bit, but think of it like this. Climate models divide the world into grid boxes, but lots of important processes happen at scales smaller than those boxes, like cloud formation.
Right, inside the box.
Parameterization is the traditional way of representing the average effect of those small-scale processes. ML can learn these complex relationships directly from high-resolution data or simulations.
So it learns the rules itself rather than us having to program them in explicitly.
Exactly. And this can lead to faster calculations, emulation, or potentially more accurate representations of these crucial subgrid processes.
Do we have real-world examples of this ML in climate models?
Yeah, absolutely. Some early work used neural networks to improve how models handle radiative transfer, how energy moves through the atmosphere, which is computationally very heavy.
Yeah.
More recently, we've seen really sophisticated ML models developed specifically for weather forecasting and climate prediction.
Mm.
Things like Huawei's Pangu weather model, or using specific types of neural networks like convolutional LSTMs to predict El Nino patterns.
Pangu.
Yeah, these ML-based models are sometimes showing results comparable to, or even better than, traditional physics-based models for certain tasks, and often much faster.
Wow, okay. This paints a really exciting picture of what's possible. But I have to assume it's not all smooth sailing. There must be some major challenges, especially in getting these benefits to the places that need them most.
You're absolutely right to ask that. There are definitely significant challenges and barriers, and they're particularly acute in many developing countries. Let's start with just the basics. Data gaps.
Right. Simply not having the data in the first place.
Exactly. For vast areas, there's a lack of consistent, long-term, reliable data, whether it's weather stations, stream gauges, population stats, you name it. And even where data exists, data quality can be a huge issue. Is it accurate? Is it complete? Is it in a usable format? Often the answer is no, or we don't know.
So you're trying to build on a shaky foundation.
It can be, yeah. And then there's the issue of potential bias in the data we do have, especially some of these newer big data sources.
Bias. How so?
Well, take the mobile phone data, the CDRs we talked about.
Yeah.
Who owns mobile phones in many parts of the world?
Probably younger people. More affluent, more urban.
Exactly. So if you base your analysis only on that data, you might get a skewed picture that doesn't represent older people or poorer rural communities, often the most vulnerable. This is called sampling bias.
Right. So your data isn't representative of everyone.
Precisely. Now, there are statistical techniques being developed to try and correct for these biases. They mentioned work done in Senegal on this, but it's a real challenge.
Okay. So data gaps, quality issues, bias.
Yeah.
What else?
Well, even if you had perfect data, you need the human and technological capacity to actually use it.
The skills and the tools.
Yeah. Gathering, cleaning, analyzing, interpreting this complex data, integrating it into planning, that requires expertise that's often in short supply, especially in the global south. There is a quote from Claire Melamed highlighted about the explosion of data simply outpacing the ability to make sense of it in poorer countries.
That makes sense. It's one thing to generate data, another to use it effectively.
And it's not just analysts. You need IT specialists, data managers. And there's a problem where trained people might get hired away by commercial companies offering better pay.
The brain drain issue.
Exactly. So capacity building is crucial, but also retaining that capacity.
Okay, so we have data issues, capacity issues. What about getting everyone to work together? Coordination.
That's another huge one. Bottlenecks in coordination, communication, and self-organization. Often, the different players, the private companies holding data, the scientists analyzing it, government agencies, NGOs, donors, they work in silos.
Right, everyone doing their own thing.
Which leads to duplication of effort or missed opportunities. There's often a lack of clear structures to bring everyone together. And this contributes to what's sometimes called the decision gap. You might have the information, the warning, but it doesn't lead to action on the ground.
Why not?
Well, maybe the warning doesn't reach everyone it needs to, or maybe it's not communicated clearly. People don't understand what they're supposed to do.
Or maybe they don't trust the source.
That too. And this is where understanding local context, local knowledge, sociocultural factors is so vital. You can't just parachute in with data. You need to build relationships, trust, networks for knowledge exchange, not just one-way information flow.
Right. It has to connect with people's lived reality.
Absolutely. The report mentioned a case in Mozambique where a flood resettlement program didn't work well because the policymaker's view of risk and land use was totally different from the local farmers' perspectives. A real disconnect.
A cautionary tale.
Yeah.
And scaling things up.
Yeah.
If you have a successful pilot project.
That's another common bottleneck. Moving from a small-scale success to a national or regional program often faces huge hurdles. Political, financial, logistical.
And throughout all this, there must be ethical considerations too.
Definitely. You're dealing with potentially sensitive data, especially from mobile phones or social media. So ensuring ethical data gathering, protecting privacy, getting proper consent where needed, that's paramount.
And the bias issue we talked about. That has ethical dimensions too, right?
Absolutely. If your training data for an AI model is biased, the predictions or decisions it makes could be unfair, potentially disadvantaging already vulnerable groups. So fairness and equity are major ethical concerns.
Okay, quite a list of challenges. So acknowledging all that, how do we move forward? What are the recommendations, the future directions?
Well, one key idea is shifting towards a more integrated data portfolio approach.
Data portfolio?
Yeah, meaning don't rely on just one type of data. Combine the new stuff, CDRs, social media, satellite data, with traditional methods like ground sensors, surveys, administrative records, and make sure your portfolio covers both sudden disasters like earthquakes and slow onset ones like drought.
A blended approach makes sense.
And critically, invest in those methods to correct for bias in the big data sources. Make the data more representative.
Okay. What about the coordination problem?
That requires really focusing on facilitating communication and collaboration among all the stakeholders we mentioned. How do we break down those silos? How do we democratize access to data and analysis tools so that local communities and decision makers can actually use them effectively?
Building bridges between groups.
Yes, and closely related is the need to seriously invest in building local capacity, both human skills and technological infrastructure within developing countries themselves. Sustainable solutions need local ownership.
Right. Not just relying on outside experts indefinitely.
Exactly. And addressing those bottlenecks in communication and action requires building active, ongoing relationships between the people providing information and the people who need to use it. Maybe using things like interactive simulations or games could help people understand risks better and plan responses more effectively.
Interesting idea. And what about the future of the tech itself, like AI and ML?
The potential is still huge, but the transition into routine, operational use needs care. We need robust ways to test if the findings from ML research are actually reliable and applicable in the real world. And those ethical considerations, fairness, transparency, accountability, need to be front and center as these tools become more powerful.
Responsible innovation.
Precisely. And on the data collection side, especially satellites, we'll likely see continued growth in things like SAR synthetic aperture radar.
SAR.
Yeah, it's useful because it can see through clouds, which is obviously great for monitoring tropical regions or during storm events. SAR microsatellites are becoming more common and accessible.
Alongside the optical satellites we already use a lot.
Exactly. Optical data remains crucial for monitoring deforestation, greenhouse gas emissions, land use changes, all vital climate indicators. And underlying all of this is the continued need for international collaboration and data sharing. Climate change and disasters don't respect borders.
Like the ozone layer example. International agreements based on shared science led to action.
That's a perfect example of what's possible when the world works together based on shared data and understanding.
Okay, so wrapping this up, it feels like the core message is big data offers this enormous potential, especially for developing countries facing climate change and disaster risks.
Huge potential, yeah.
But unlocking it isn't just about having more data or fancier algorithms.
Not at all. It's really about tackling those fundamental challenges. The data gaps and biases, the capacity limits, the coordination failures, the ethical questions.
And connecting the data to real people and real decisions on the ground.
Exactly. It needs a holistic approach. Building truly resilient communities requires more than just technology. It requires addressing those underlying vulnerabilities and fostering real societal learning and collaboration.
That's a really clear and comprehensive overview. Thanks for walking us through that. It definitely leaves me with a thought, maybe for you listening too. Given how fast these data technologies are advancing, how do we genuinely make sure they get used effectively and equitably? How do we ensure these powerful tools actually build resilience for everyone, everywhere, and move beyond just tech fixes to tackle those deeper issues of vulnerability and foster real, lasting change?
That's the critical question, isn't it?
It really is. Something to mull over. Thanks again for this fantastic deep dive today. And for everyone listening, we really encourage you to check out some of the organizations and reports we touched on if you want to explore this vital topic further.